Well, it's good to see you this morning. My name is Kevin. I'm the worship director here at The River. And we're just beginning a new series in the book of Colossians. And as we get into it this morning, I'd like to tell you a story. When I finished college, I had my final paper to turn in. And back then, it was paper. I was carrying my paper across the campus to turn it in to my final professor of my college career. And so I found him in his office, and I laid it on his desk, and I said to him, you know, this is it. This is my final paper. After this, I'm done. And I think he could tell that I wanted some words of profundity to send me out into the world. So he sized me up, and he said, life is not a rubber ball, Kevin. And so I had no idea what that meant. But for fear that this was some kind of final test that would affect my grade, I smiled and I got out of there as soon as I could. But as I walked, you know, back to my apartment with this phrase rattling around in my head, I wondered just what in the world did it actually mean? There's a surface level explanation about a rubber ball that makes some sense. It bounces, and it's kind of unpredictable in the way it bounces. So life is like that. But later in life, I had children. I had two boys, in fact, and so I spent a lot of time around rubber balls and all kinds of balls in general. And so this phrase was rattling around in my brain again. What does it mean, you know? Ultimately, the core message of whatever he meant remains mysterious but expansive. It grows with me. And I'd argue, you know, that much of Scripture works that way as well. It often, not always, but often is simply expressed, simply told. But as we enter different phases of life, it grows with us as we experience life in different ways. And as we enter the first chapter of the book of Colossians, we're going to see a piece here that feels like that. It makes sense to us on a certain level, but it's very expansive, very juicy, very stratified with meaning. Scholars have come to call this section the hymn to the supremacy of Christ, which sounds like a Wagner opera or something. But in the letter, Paul does his usual hellos and usual salutations, and then we find this in chapter 1, verse 15. He says, "The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and one of my favorite lines in all Scripture, in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross." Amen, indeed. Now, the basic message here is beautiful. It's full of comfort, and even as it remains a little bit mysterious to us, Jesus, this poor man from a rural community who lived and died about 60 years before this was written, somehow is the center of the whole universe, and somehow, mysteriously, is holding all things together. And what's more, he has supremacy, he has authority and control and agency over everything. What a wonderfully broad and powerful idea. Amen? Amen. Now, a little bit of context here. If we compare the teachings of Jesus with the writings and the teachings of Paul, we find some differences. Jesus was on the ground with people in communities, and these were poor, agriculturally minded people. And Jesus talked in simple stories. He talked like a rabbi would talk. He said, "You have heard this said, but I say this." And he would say, "The kingdom of God is like this." And he told stories. And like Jesus, Paul was an itinerant preacher, but his audience was a little different. As this Jesus movement moved out and spread throughout the ancient world and into Asia, it's going into the bigger cities where people are educated. They're more well-versed in the Greco-Roman thought system. And so instead of telling stories about coins and fields and fig trees and things like that, Paul is writing and saying things like describing Jesus as the firstborn from among the dead and things like that. It's almost as if long before the Enlightenment, Paul is expanding the Jesus movement into the life of the mind, which is where we live these days, right? His writings seem to define so well for us as Western people what it means to be a Christ follower, because they're analytical writings. They're almost psychedelic, like this passage. But the good news of this passage is, guess what? Jesus, and to his audience, this might have been for some of them somebody that they had seen and heard or heard of, this man who did miraculous things is not just a local wisdom figure. He is God's son and reigns over the cosmos. This is good news. Now take a look at this circle image and go with me on a thought example here. So let's imagine at the core of it is you, who you are, what makes up your moral character, your personality, and just the essence of you. And if we move out from that center as all the systems of the world, the next circle might be your family, your local community, and local places like this church, local things that you do, restaurants you go to, the smaller circle that surrounds your inner circle. Moving out from there, where your parents might have worked, where you work, where you do your shopping. Moving out from there, we have local and municipal governments and so forth. Moving out from there, we have national governments. And then we have movements like capitalism, socialism, communism, worldwide systems, the UN, NATO, the League of Nations, the World Bank, the G7. Now let's throw the natural world in there, in the outer circles, our ecology, how the system of the world works, how nature and animals work and interact. And then further out, we have the moon, the solar system, the Milky Way, and the unexplored regions of space. Now Paul is saying Jesus is over all these systems and holding them all together, everything. You know, this is good news for us, right? And a lot of times in our spirituality, especially in church, we focus on the middle, right? What's going on in here? What's going on with me? What do I think? How do I feel? How do I pray? What do I do with my life? Because we have very little agency over the other circles, right? And it can feel like, well, this is the only thing I control, so let's talk about this. But the reason we're talking about artificial intelligence this morning, and Ned's going to come up and share with us, is that these outer systems, they do have an influence on us. And even though we don't really have an influence on them, especially on the outer ones, they speak to us and speak to our lives about how we live. So there's a tension here in that, and you know, there often is in biblical teaching and spiritual teaching, there's a tension between what's said and what's on the page and how things actually are. God is over all things and in control of all things. But how many of us, don't raise your hand, but I will, don't feel that way? There's a lot of systems in this world that feel, they feel the opposite way. They feel out of control. So there's a tension in this passage. If Christ is holding all things together, what do we do when we don't feel that way? Well, when we don't feel that way, we live from a place of fear. And fear is like the Dwayne Johnson of emotions. It can do anything, apparently. You know, it can make us angry, it can lead us into despair, depression, anxiety, prejudice, bigotry, violence, confusion. It's unstoppable. So when we don't live as if God is holding all things together, we can live differently because we're afraid and we don't believe we're in God's care. You know, one of the systems that can create fear for us and has been creating some fear of late, especially with Silicon Valley people, is artificial intelligence. Now, when I was a kid growing up in the 1970s and the 1980s, this was artificial intelligence. Okay, does anybody remember 2XL? 2XL. So 2XL was a robot, and he needed no batteries. It says right there on the box. You could plug him in. Well, 2XL knew everything, as long as it was a binary trivia question. He knew everything. It was amazing. And he communicated in a very cheerful voice, "I'm 2XL, press the button." And there's no wonder Gen X people ended up depressed and deranged, because we're all locked in our bedrooms after school with no adult supervision listening to 2XL. But the truth is, 2XL was not a robot at all. He was an 8-track tape player. Do you see that there? That was his brain. That was artificial intelligence in the 1970s and 1980s. But AI now is much, much more powerful, and I hope that's an obvious statement. But we wanted to, again, deal with some of the systems in our world that surround us and deal with it from a Christ-centered perspective. And so to do that, we'd like to invite a good friend of ours. He's a founder of a company who deals with AI. He's also a member of Christian Entrepreneurs, who are seeking to use AI in a redemptive and intelligent way in our societies and in our businesses. Would you welcome, please, our good friend, Najib Tozin.
Thanks, Kevin. Hello, church. So I had a chance to do a sermon at the River. It was my very first one. The beginning of the year, about science and faith. Were any of you there for that one? All right. So I talked about awe and wonder, the Big Bang, expansion of the universe, all that kind of stuff. So if you were one of those people who thought that talk was a little bit like out there, we're taking it to a whole new level today. So get ready. Are you with me on that? All right. So some context is that last month, I had a chance to be part of a gathering of Christian entrepreneurs and investors who really came over from all over the world. And we were meeting to discuss how to leverage entrepreneurship, technology, capital towards redemptive purposes in the world that would advance God's kingdom. And one of the main topics that we kept coming back to was AI, because so many of us are seeing this as the most transformational technology of our lifetimes. And it's also an area where, frankly, the Christian perspective and the Christian voice is not well represented at all. And I was talking about this with Brad, and he thought it would be helpful to share with the broader congregation. And that's kind of when I realized that between this and my science and faith talk, I have become the unofficial nerd in residence at the River. And I will embrace that. That is a good thing. So really, I have two main objectives today. The first is to help everyone be aware of what's happening in AI and what may be coming so we can better equip ourselves and our families. And there is actually a lot that's coming. And the second is really to share a Christ-centered framework on AI that really can provide an initial basis for how to think about and how to engage with this technology as it gets more widespread. So I'm just gonna start with first, what is AI? So AI, or artificial intelligence, is the ability of a machine to perform cognitive functions that humans do. These are things like perceiving, learning, reasoning, problem solving, that kind of stuff. And the way artificial intelligence is built is through a process called machine learning. This is different from software coding because in this case, the AI is trained on lots and lots of data. And in a method that has some similarities to how our own brain works and how it learns, the AI algorithm actually determines the connections and the patterns and all that data so it can navigate the world and make predictions about how it should respond to inputs. That's kind of, in a nutshell, how it works. And some of our earliest contacts with AI were actually with games. When I say games, I'm talking like checkers, chess, that kind of thing. And that's because games are actually very straightforward to train these types of models on. Games aren't messy like the real world. There are fixed rules. There's a clear winner and a loser at the end. And they can be trained on lots and lots and lots of individual matches. So in 1997, the chess-playing system called Deep Blue, which was actually a very early and very basic form of AI, defeated the human world chess champion, Garry Kasparov. Is there anyone out there old enough to remember when this happened? I don't know how many people were sort of, some of us. It was actually kind of a close game at the time, but Today, it's actually not even close. The AI models over the last 15 years or so can run circles around humans in chess. No world champion can even come close to being a computer. So I'm afraid our era of dominance in chess has ended. And I remember at the time when Kasparov lost to Deep Blue, there were some fears that having computers be better at humans in chess would kind of make chess less popular, discourage people from learning the game. But you know, those fears never actually materialized. Actually, chess today is more popular than it's ever been. And then meanwhile, the engineers moved on to many, you know, even more complicated games like Jeopardy, like Go, and I'm sorry to report, but the computers have all completely crushed all the human competition. So the AI has sort of beat the beat people in games. But you know, computers able to play games better than we are. I mean, it's interesting. Maybe it's a little unsettling, but it's not really going to change our lives or give us like an existential crisis. But in the last couple of years, there have been some major breakthroughs in AI. And as computers have become increasingly powerful and able to process more and more data, and as AI machine learning methods have gotten more and more sophisticated, AI has been able to move out of the much more simple realm of games and into the messy world of real life. And it's been able to do that surprisingly effectively. So as training data in this case, the machine learning algorithms have been able to take in basically everything humans have ever created, as long as it's somewhere on the internet. So that means every blog post, every YouTube video, every podcast, every song, every sermon. This sermon, when it gets posted on the internet, will get, you know, ingested into the AI. Every piece of art, trillions of photos. I mean, just so much content. And based on that, these new AI applications can actually start interacting with the real world in some pretty convincing ways. I mean, that ranges a bunch of different applications, like spatial navigation. Those are things like self-driving vehicles, robotics, writing and communication, and even the generation of pictures and audio and video. So these recent breakthroughs have resulted in an explosion of AI applications. And this image here shows just, you know, some of the AI companies that have started up in the last couple of years. Most of these haven't been commercialized yet, so it's kind of giving an idea of what's coming. And all these little logos here are only in the country of Israel. So this gives you a sense worldwide, there's lots and lots and lots that's coming. And you have a lot of smart people in the field who now believe that AI is going to transform pretty much every industry over the next decade. And that means that AI is going to touch almost every aspect of our lives, whether directly or indirectly. So Andrew Ng, who's a co-founder and head of Google Brain and Stanford professor, said, just as electricity transformed almost everything 100 years ago, today I actually have a hard time thinking of an industry that I don't think AI will transform in the next several years. And you know, I want to point out that just like any technology, there's applications that can be good or bad. And AI can be used in some really cool ways, really amazing ways that can enhance human flourishing, and that I think we should all be genuinely excited about. And there's lots of examples of this, and I'm just gonna share one. So this newest version of AlphaFold, called AlphaFold 3, was just launched by Google DeepMind, and just a few weeks ago, on May 20th. And this is a really cool breakthrough. Basically, in the latest version, with an input of a DNA sequence, the AlphaFold 3 can predict the three-dimensional structure of the protein that it codes for, but not just the structure, but it can also figure out the function of that protein and what elements it's gonna interact with and what it's not gonna interact with. And that's really cool, really insane. Before this, there was no way humans could actually do this on their own. It was a slow trial and error process. It took a lot of money and a lot of time to figure out. And this is expected to really speed up the development of medicines and drugs and cancer treatments. And many people are saying that this is going to open up a whole new era for enhancing human health and treating diseases. And I think this is super exciting. But I want to spend a little time talking about the developments in AI that are, frankly, in a more uncomfortable gray area that I think bring up some profound ethical and spiritual questions. Now, many of you may be aware of this already for some of these, but I'm just going to take a quick trip into some of these more unsettling applications that start to feel increasingly uncomfortable. It's just to get us all on the same page. So first of all, I'm sure all of you have heard of ChatGPT. The latest versions in the last few months can now pass the bar exam, the LSAT, every AP test, the SAT, and it actually doesn't just pass, but it aces these tests. And you know, until a few months ago, passing these kinds of proficiency tests was something only humans can do, and that was after years of education and training. So yeah, it makes us wonder, like, what does it mean if a computer can now outperform us on these kinds of proficiency tests? And beyond just test taking, AI-generated images or art is getting really, really impressive. All the images on the screen here are generated by AI, basically just from a text description of the artwork or the image that the person wanted created. And then the AI gives you multiple options to choose from, and you can modify it from there. And the picture in the center actually made national news when it was awarded first prize in a Colorado art a digital art competition that was judged by a panel of art experts. And after the fact, they found out it was actually generated by someone who used an AI image generator. And then there's AI-generated music. And as someone who writes and records music, I have to admit, I find this both disturbing and a little offensive. Because I'm not interested in listening to music that's not created by like actual human beings, but I have to admit it's getting increasingly difficult to tell the difference between the two. And you know, just to give you a sense of the capabilities, a few days ago I used the AI free song generator, it's called the Suno, and requested it to generate, I said, a Christian rock song about the River Church. In San Jose. So that's all I said. Christian rock song, River Church in San Jose. So it spit out a full song, actually spit out two full songs that I could choose from. And it took about 15 seconds. And I'm just gonna play you a quick 20 second clip of what it generated for us. Yeah, I know. I can kind of tell by the reactions, it's like, ah, kind of like, it's funny, and it's like, it's a little disturbing too, you know? So it's like this weird mix of emotions. And recently, there have been breakthroughs in making AI-generated video as well, which is what you will see be playing in the background here. And this particular tool isn't available to the public yet, but these tools are expected to publicly release in a matter of some months, and it's already causing some movie studios, to put their new investments on hold because they think this is going to be so incredibly disruptive to their business. And these are just generated through text prompts, and then it generates these videos. Now, when I see these kinds of AI applications, I don't know how you all feel, but you know, I feel this mix of like, wow, this is amazing, but also kind of a sadness. Like, wait a minute, I thought this was something that only humans could do, and now a computer can just spit it out, like within a few seconds. And you know, honestly, maybe a little bit of anger too, like kind of the promise of technology that It was supposed to do all the menial stuff for us, you know, the stuff we didn't like, so we could spend more time on making art, writing music, writing, that kind of thing. But it seems like in these latest applications, AI is doing the writing and making the art and the music and the film, and, you know, we're left washing dishes, doing laundry, all that stuff still. So that seems unfair. Now, I'm going to share one last example with you. And this is from a demo last month from OpenAI. That was their latest version of ChatGPT. And this version now interacts with you not just by text, but also by voice. And it actually can even see you on video and respond to what it is seeing. So let's just take a quick look at what it can do.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Rocky. I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm awesome. Listen, I got some huge news.
Oh, do tell. I'm all ears.
Well, in a few minutes, I'm going to be interviewing at OpenAI. Have you heard of them?
OpenAI? Huh? Sounds vaguely familiar. Kidding, of course. That's incredible, Rocky. What kind of interview?
Well, it's for a software engineering role, but I just need to know, do I look presentable, professional?
Well, Rocky, you definitely have the I've been coding all night look down, which could actually work in your favor. Maybe just run a hand through your hair or lean into the mad genius vibe. Well, your enthusiasm is what's really going to shine through.
I don't have a lot of time, so I'm just going to throw this on. What do you think?
Oh, Rocky, that's quite a statement piece. I mean, you'll definitely stand out. Though maybe not in the way you're hoping for an interview.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah, so I want to emphasize here that even though this chatbot can interact with us like it's a real person, and in fact, it almost sounds like it's flirting with Rocky here, AI is not conscious. The way it works, it's just running a lot of math and calculations based on the patterns it has found from everything humans have created. And by ingesting the whole internet, these AI algorithms can actually mimic human behavior and interact with the real world in ways that are pretty convincing and often unsettling. And I think we need to be aware that there's a real risk, especially for young people, for senior citizens, or just people struggling with loneliness, that it could become increasingly tempting to replace real human connections with artificial relationships. And we're already seeing massive amounts of funding going into companies that are working on creating AI companions, AI girlfriends, AI boyfriends. And for many people, you know, this might feel like a preferable or easier alternative to making real human connections. And I can tell you what we just saw there is really just sort of the very entry-level version of this, because you're gonna have these applications where you can see an image of the, you know, your companion talking to you, it'll download information about you, it'll be really customized. And you know, once it builds that trust with you, it could nudge you to start buying stuff. And you know, there's just all kinds of weird directions this could go. So as these AI applications become more mainstream, I think there are going to be some really profound questions that people are going to be increasingly wrestling with. Like, what does it even mean to be human? What is even real? And what's authentic? Like, what applications of AI should we be excited about and embracing? And which ones should we be pushing back against? And I actually think as these types of questions come up more and more, the church has a really unique opportunity, because people with a secular worldview, I really believe, are going to struggle to answer these types of deep questions in a compelling way. But as Christians, I think we actually have some very compelling answers and a perspective that can provide encouragement and hope and a degree of moral clarity as well. And we might find in this season that I believe is going to be a season of a profound disruption, that there are going to be more and more people open to faith. So that's something we need to be aware of. So you know, going back to this Christian entrepreneur gathering I went to, there was this initial framework developed around how to think about, how to approach AI that I think is a really helpful starting point for us to consider. This was put together by Christian tech leaders in AI, as well as some pastors and theologians. Andy Crouch, who some of you may be aware of, he's the author of the TechWise family and was a former managing editing director of Christianity Today, was part of that team, and he synthesized the thinking into an overall thesis. I'm just gonna be sharing an abridged version of what Andy put together. I'm not gonna be able to do it justice in the time we have today, but at the end of the talk, I will share a couple links where you can learn more, including to get the full unabridged version of that thesis. So this framework starts with some statements about what we as Christians believe in the context of AI. So first, we believe that human beings are the enduring image of God. So we believe that human beings, for the duration of the human story, will uniquely remain entrusted with bearing the image of God. You know, AI may be able to mimic our behavior or the creative output of human beings, but at the end of the day, it is only an echo of us. Human beings remain precious beyond all measure and are irreplaceable, regardless of our output or our accomplishments or our efficiency. Now, second, we believe that as fallen creatures, in the course of the human story, we become captive to a pattern of deceptions that have corrupted the divine image and compromised our ability to pursue or even to know what's best for us. And I think we see, you know, many examples of this, but one persistent deception that's gone on throughout history, and we can see in our society too, is that we can be fulfilled without God, and that we can be fulfilled without reliance on other people. If only we just had enough money or enough power or enough pleasurable things to entertain and distract us. Now, as Christians, we know that these kinds of things can give us some measure of satisfaction in the short term, but we also know that these, at the end of the day, are idols, and they won't fulfill us. And ultimately, what will fulfill us is relationship. First and foremost, relationship with God, but also relationship with family, with friends, with our community. That is what we are wired for. And third, you know, really just like any technology, AI has a potential for both good and for evil. AI can be expected to unlock some many wonderful things that were previously totally inaccessible to us. I talked about AlphaFold. I think that's a great example of that. But there are going to be attempts to use AI to try and replace relationships or to be a replacement for human creativity or human agency. And because AI has absorbed everything humans have created, it's been trained on the best of us and the worst of us, the wisest of us and the most foolish. So it's also subject to all the same patterns of deception that we are prone to. So with that in mind, that kind of overall thinking, here are some filters that we can use when we consider what applications of AI have the potential to be redemptive as opposed to which ones we should be wary of. Now, this framework really was made for developers of AI technology, but I actually think that this also applies really well to all of us who have to interact with this technology, you know, on a day-to-day basis and are increasingly going to be confronted with these different kinds of AI applications that want to come into our lives and into our families. And I think this can give us a bit of a framework to think about what kinds of applications that we embrace or take into our homes or let our kids use, or whether we let our organizations use, and which ones we should be wary of. So the first is, you know, AI applications that really advance human flourishing ultimately should inform but not replace human agency. And, you know, this can span a lot of different areas, but for example, tools that can help artists create and fulfill their artistic vision, I think are wonderful things, rather than AI applications that are really designed to just replace the artist. Applications that can inform doctors and patients with better information so they can make better decisions about healthcare, I think is a beautiful thing. Or tools that can help inform leaders and leadership teams so they can make better decisions for their organization. These are tools that can inform, but they don't replace the human in the middle. Second would be applications that develop but not diminish human cognitive capacity. And there are lots of examples of this. There are AI tools being developed for students and for teachers to better customize learning plans for the kids that can help each of them learn and stretch themselves to reach their individual full potential. I think that's a beautiful thing. Or tools that can help artists and writers and musicians grow and become their best creative selves. I think there's a lot of opportunity for that. Third would be respecting and advancing human embodiment. I think increasingly technology has sucked us into our screens or into virtual worlds, but there are some really interesting applications of AI that can enable us to have healthier and more active bodies. It can encourage us to even get outside and be fit, things like wearables, or they can encourage us for fitness, or they can help us regulate our bodies so we can live longer, healthier lives. And then finally, to serve personal relationships, but not to replace them. I talked about the AI companion, girlfriend, boyfriend thing, which is concerning. But I think there are some really exciting tools that are in development. There's one, for instance, a translation tool that can help us communicate across language barriers in real time, that actually can preserve our tone of voice and our mannerisms when it's translating in the other language. And I think that could be such a cool way to bridge cultural gaps. I know I personally would have loved to have had this as a kid to communicate with my Turkish-speaking grandmother, and I spoke some broken Turkish, but if we could have had that kind of conversation, that would have really enriched that relationship. That would have been a wonderful thing. So, there are so many aspects of AI that I didn't cover. So there's a lot of other topics, and frankly, it would require like a whole series to go through everything. So really the purpose of sharing this with you all today is really to start a conversation about what I think is going to be an increasingly important topic in our culture, and it's likely going to have an increasing influence in all of our lives. And I think sometimes the church is a little behind the game when it comes to these big sort of tectonic technological changes that do have kind of societal impacts and ethical and moral implications. So the hope of this is to get ahead of this a little bit before things really start developing and impacting us. So I want to end just by rereading a portion of what Kevin shared. So in Colossians, Paul writes, "The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together." So we need to be confident that God is in it all. I mean, God is not surprised at all that we developed artificial intelligence. He knew that we would eventually develop these kinds of AI tools, and ultimately God is in control. But God also calls us to be his instruments of peace in the world and to bring applications of these technologies that are redemptive and not destructive. And I pray that God would grant us all wisdom and that he would use the church, and by the church I mean all of us collectively and individually, to apply this technology in ways in our organizations, in our families, in our personal lives, that lead to human flourishing and to the advancement of God's kingdom. So I've included a couple resources here on the screen for anyone interested in learning more. So for one thing, that redemptive thesis I was talking about that Andy Crouch synthesized, the link for that was like way too long to put on here. So if you just Google AI Praxis, Praxis is the name of that community that I was talking about, AI Praxis Redemptive Thesis, it'll be the first link that comes up. There's another great online resource called Church and AI, which is the beginning, really, of an exploration of AI and its potential effects on the church. And with that, thank you for letting me talk about this topic, which I know is a little out there, but I do think it's going to become more and more relevant in our society, especially given that we're all in the heart of Silicon Valley. And from there, I'm going to turn it back to Kevin, who can close us out in prayer and worship.